to release him next month on February 26th.
Resistance movements have also poured praise on Abu Hawash, saying his victory should remind Palestinians how they can win every battle against Israel. The 40-year-old father of five children was arrested in October 2020 and started his hunger strike early 5 months ago to protest his detention without charge or trial that is allowed under Israel's administrative detention system. His lengthy hunger strike once again shed light on this illegal practice. Out of 7,000 Palestinians in Israeli jails, more than 500 are locked up without facing any charges or having a trial. For many of them, the last choice against this inhumane measure is to stop eating for lengthy periods of time. Still, the majority find themselves locked up in deplorable and non-standard conditions of the Israeli prisons, where they are sometimes even subjected to systematic torture and harassment.
In late 2020, Americans went to the ballots to pick the country's next president. 4 days after votes closed, Joe Biden was declared the winner. But the incumbent leader, Donald Trump, alleged vote fraud, and in doing so, shattered Washington's self-proclaimed image of the cradle of democracy. Trump adamantly refused to concede defeat after losing the 2020 presidential vote. On January 6, 2021, he called on his supporters to march on the Capitol and, quote, stop the steal. His fans attempted to do that. The world was shocked as news networks around the world showed thousands of Trump supporters forcing their way into the Capitol building, the symbol of U.S. democracy. Lawmakers engaged in the process of certifying the presidential election had to stop their task and flee for their lives. Some reports even suggest that a Republican senator was so frightened that he asked the Capitol security repeatedly to shoot the protesters. 5 people died in the chaos, one of them in the Congress building. To date, American authorities have arrested nearly 600 people and are looking for hundreds of more suspects. A big portion of the defendants stand accused of assaulting police officers. The FBI asked U.S. citizens to report each other out and tell the police if they knew anyone who had taken part in the riots. The incident inevitably had adverse consequences for the United States' image, both domestically and internationally. An opinion poll conducted last year by Harvard University showed that more than half of the country's young generation thought that American democracy is in trouble or failing. Moreover, an Axios survey indicated that now only 51% of the U.S. public thinks the next presidential election will be fair and free. Also, the Democracy Perception Index for 2021 showed that 44% of participants perceived the U.S. influence and meddling in the affairs of their countries as the biggest threat to democracy in their nations. At the same time, politicians and political analysts expressed shock and disgust at the chaotic scenes at the Congress grounds. Richard N. Haas, the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, said the attack signaled a post-American era. The assault on the Capitol changed the face of Washington, D.C. as well. The Congress building was fenced off on multiple occasions after the riots. Furthermore, Joe Biden's inauguration was carried out under heavy military presence, with an unprecedented 25,000 troops ensuring security. That was bigger than the number of U.S. forces present in Iraq and Afghanistan on the same day. The police reaction to the Capitol riots also raised questions about the U.S. law enforcement's differential treatment of white protesters. Whereas black people could be killed and injured for much smaller crimes, police were in fact criticized for their late and subdued response to the deadly protests by Trump's supporters.
Representatives of resistance groups gathered in Beirut to pay tribute to Iran's top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. The two anti-terror icons were assassinated in an American drone strike outside Baghdad airport on January 3, 2020. Participants in the event all agreed that Soleimani united the region in the face of a common threat posed by the U.S. and Israel.
Their martyrdom did not weaken the resistance. On the contrary, it led to more accomplishments and success for the resistance. They are alive. This type of life is what gives a strength to the resistance. Martyr Qasem transcended his country to become the martyr of the entire nation, and this is an exceptional characteristic.
Hezbollah Deputy Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qasem stressed that people in the region will stand united and confront the threat posed by the United States. Meanwhile, the Secretary General of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad Movement, Ziad Nakhala, described Soleimani as the martyr of Palestine and Al-Quds.
The U.S. assassinated Soleimani because he was a barrier to American-Israeli plots in the region. He transformed the resistance fighters into a strategic threat to Israel and the U.S. I take this opportunity to say that we're proud of the positions of the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is unwavering in its support for the Palestinian resistance, and I witnessed that Qasem Soleimani was at the forefront of the fight in defense of Palestine and the people of Palestine.
The Iranian ambassador to Beirut also said that there is a joint Iranian-Iraqi judicial lawsuit being followed up by both countries to try the killers of the Iranian and Iraqi martyrs who were assassinated by the United States.
Resistance groups in the region consider General Qasem Soleimani as a man and a leader who united them. People in Lebanon, even those who knew him only after his martyrdom, see him as a man who transcended borders and sacrificed his life for the sake of the people and regional peace and stability. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
This international conference is the gathering of Islamic scholars converged in the port city of Karachi against Islamophobia. They believe Islamophobia is a Western project to reshape Islam with tools like Daesh and others.
Participants of the conference stressed on the need of unity among Muslims and called on the Islamic countries to take serious notice of the forces hell-bent to sow seed of discords among Muslim Ummah.
Documentary films during the past years over the gruesome acts of Daesh in the name of Islam were played to remind people how terrorist groups were weaponized by Israel and the U.S. to distort the face of Islam in the West.
Actually, Islamophobia is a project of Western country who do not like the Western people come to Islam like Islam. And they mention many things that hurt the heart of the Islamic people, while Islam is the religious of love between the people.
This conference is very important for me, all Pakistanis, and all Muslims, because there has been so many criminal activities on behalf of non-Muslims or Western countries against Islam and Muslims.
Member of the international conference warned the Islamic countries to act quickly against the possible future threats given the previous experience with the West.
Islamophobia had been created to balance the teachings of Ahle Bayt alayhimus salam. It was created to balance and misguide people from the way of Quran and Sunnah. Things took place in the name of Daesh and so-called. And they did things which were absolutely against the teachings of Islam. They never understood.
The delegation in the conference also stressed the significance of the eradication of Daesh from Iraq and Syria to save Islam and also save humanity from the plague of terrorist groups like Daesh, which is seen as a Western plot against Islam and the Islamic community. Mohammed Turi, Karachi.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Liberal Democrat leader Ed Davey said the UK needs ambitious climate policies, but they will always be better if we work together with international partners. The Conservatives' failure to do this is now hitting British business at the worst possible time, as energy-intensive firms are struggling with sky-high gas prices. We'll prepare for you an article written by environment correspondent Fiona Harvey. The piece is titled, Brexit Decision Left UK Firms Paying 10% More Than EU Rivals for Emissions. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. British businesses are paying substantially more to produce carbon dioxide than their EU rivals because of the government's refusal to link the UK carbon market to the bigger European market after Brexit. The difference is putting UK industry at a significant competitive disadvantage to European rivals at a time of soaring energy prices, but does not result in any additional benefit to the environment. British companies are paying more than £75, that is €90 a tonne, for the carbon they emit, while similar industries in the European Union are paying up to about €85 a tonne. The difference has narrowed slightly in recent days, but was reaching about €8 to €9 a tonne of carbon in the past month, equating to a premium of about 10%. Being paid by British companies. Britain's carbon price is higher because the UK carbon market, set up last year with the first permit auctions taking place last May, is much smaller and lacks the liquidity of the larger European Union Emissions Trading Scheme, or EU ETS, that has been operating since 2005 and covers all of the European Union's heavy industries. Under both schemes, companies buy tradable permits to cover the carbon dioxide they produce, with cleaner companies able to sell spares to laggards. The price acts as an incentive to companies to clean up their operations and is seen as an economically efficient way to help meet the net zero emissions target. Ministers have a short window in which to reduce UK carbon prices before 18th of January. The deadline for the government to release extra permits onto the market, which could reduce some of the price pressure. But experts said linking to the European Union market would provide a better longer-term answer and make economic and environmental sense. Tom Lord, the head of the trading at Redshaw Advisors, said British companies are paying substantially more than they are in the European Union. The big problem for the UK market is liquidity and the fact that it is new. The European Union has a historic surplus of permits to fall back on, but the UK has pent-up demand and only a drip feed of supply. Lawson Steele, joint head of carbon and utilities research at Berenberg Bank, said, "This is a disadvantage to UK companies. The reality is that the United Kingdom carbon market is dwarfed by the European Union's ETS. Given that the UK wants to trade with the European Union and the European Union wants to trade with the United Kingdom, it would make sense for companies to be on the same carbon footing." British companies already pay higher prices for energy than their EU counterparts, amounting to about £35 a megawatt hour more, added Joe Morris of UK Steel, which represents the steel industry. Joe Morris added, "This is a long-running bugbear for the steel sector and something that continues to hamper our international competitiveness. He said the effect of both higher carbon prices and higher energy prices than the European Union, as well as the lack of a post-Brexit deal with the United States, which recently dropped its tariffs on EU steel, was to deter investment, adding, "This affects the competitiveness of steel companies, which links to investment in these companies. It affects our members' confidence and does not help people who work in the sector." Joe Morris added, "Steel companies were firmly behind the net zero strategy, seeing the push for decarbonization as offering a competitive advantage." He said, "There's an opportunity to be world-leading in green steel and net zero steel." Berenberg Steel added politicians tempted by high energy prices to dismantle net zero policies were mistaken. He said, "Blaming the carbon price is baloney. Increasing energy prices in the last year have been 85% due to the gas price. Carbon is not the problem." The British government has so far not explained why it has rejected a link with the European Union system, but many suspect it is part of the desire for a clean break, hard Brexit, maintaining as few regulatory links as possible. The Liberal Democrats and the Green Party called on the government to link the UK ETS to the EU system. If the European Union agreed, linking could probably be achieved fairly easily, as the UK system is modelled on the EU market, which the UK was a core part of and took a leading role in designing and updating whilst an EU member. The Liberal Democrat leader Ed Davies said, "The United Kingdom needs ambitious climate policies, but they will always be better if we work together with international partners. The Conservatives' failure to do this is now hitting British business at the worst possible time, as energy-intensive firms are struggling with sky-high gas prices." Molly Scott-Cato, from the Green Party, said, "It's clearly irrational, inefficient, and the result of destructive Brexit ideology to try to run an independent UK carbon trading system with all of its additional costs, inevitable inconsistencies, and opportunities for gaming the market." For years after the 2008 financial crisis, the European Union's carbon market suffered a glut of permits and was largely ineffective as the carbon price crashed. However, in recent years, reforms and the renewed need to slash emissions have pushed up prices, and it is now working as intended, spurring investment in low-carbon technologies. Ministers have no plans to seek a link with the European Union ETS, but are understood not to have ruled out the possibility entirely. A spokesperson for the Department for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy said, "The UK ETS authority is considering whether to take any appropriate action under the cost containment mechanism to release more permits on the market, and will announce this decision no later than 18th of January to provide certainty to the market." Moreover, UK manufacturers have warned that Brexit will add to soaring costs facing British industry amid concerns that customs delays and red tape will rank among the biggest challenges for firms this year. Make UK, the industry body representing 20,000 manufacturing firms of all sizes from across the country, said that while optimism amongst its members had grown, it was being undermined by the after-effects of the UK's departure from the European Union. 1 year on from the end of the transition period, two-thirds of industrial company leaders in its survey of 228 firms said Brexit had moderately or significantly hampered their business. More than half of firms warned they were likely to suffer further damage this year from customs delays due to import checks and changes to product labeling. According to the 2022 Make UK PwC Senior Executive Survey, Brexit disruption remains among the biggest concerns facing industry bosses for the year ahead, as Britain's departure from the European Union complicates the fallout from COVID-19 and the rising costs facing companies. Delays at customs, the additional costs from meeting separate regulatory regimes in the UK and the European Union, and reduced access to migrant workers were among top concerns raised in the survey. The report said, "It is clear from these figures that Brexit and the global COVID-19 pandemic have had a scarring effect on the mentality of many businesses, which are traumatized by the ongoing delays and disruptions to their supply chains."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Jesus Christ called on people to follow the path of God and prosperity. January the 2nd, 1995. Jesus Christ called on people to follow the path of God and prosperity. January the 2nd, 1995. Jesus Christ called on people to follow the path of God, which is the path of prosperity for human beings, and he warned people against pursuing carnal desires and undermining their spiritual purity through engaging in evil deeds and oppressing others. The corrupt and bullying powers that are dependent on wealth and power persecuted that divine prophet and leveled insults against him. They even tried to take his life. And when God saved the life of Jesus Christ, these powers inflicted several years of horrible torture on the disciples and followers of Jesus Christ. They were trying to put an end to the teachings of Jesus Christ, which were against corruption, oppression, polytheism, causing war, deceiving people, and pursuing carnal desires. Those corrupt and oppressive powers who pursued carnal desires, caused wars against people, and deceived them, could not tolerate the existence of divine faiths and prophets. And those who followed the path of God. Today, too, those kinds of powers would not tolerate the servants of God and the followers of the divine religions or truth seekers. Following Jesus Christ, peace be upon him, requires supporting the truth and hating the powers against the truth. Hopefully, Christians and Muslims everywhere in the world will keep alive in their life and deeds this great lesson taught by Jesus Christ.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
If Jesus Christ were among us today, December 28, 1991, if Christ were among us today, he would not spare even a single moment to fight the leaders of despotism and global arrogance, nor would he tolerate the hunger and wandering of millions of people, degenerated by the hegemonic and colonialist powers into war, corruption, and violence. Jesus Christ, who is the manifestation of divine attributes, raised the flag of guiding and saving humans at a time where ignorance, injustice, and inattention to human values were prevalent. He stood up to the oppressive powers which were dependent on their wealth and power, and he promoted justice, mercy, and monotheism. Today, those who believe in that great prophet, Muslims and Christians, should follow the teachings in the path of divine prophets and try to promote human values on the basis of the teachings of these prophets.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of instrument.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to the Spotlight. Top U.S. and Russian officials have held crucial security talks, with Moscow saying the talks made no progress on Ukraine's NATO membership ban. NATO has also weighed in on the talks. All the pressure was exerted on China, or Russia, that is, when it came, for example, to Ukraine and its possible NATO membership. But Russia is not sitting idly by. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at why there was little hope of any breakthroughs, while at the same time, we will look at whether there will be any agreements, like on NATO's eastward expansion. We will also ask whether Western fears of a Russian so-called invasion of its pro-Western neighbor Ukraine is justified. Jerome Hughes joins us now from Brussels to shed light on the most recent developments. We know Russia has spoken on this. Tell us about that, because some major breakthroughs there. And, of course, from the U.S. side, if there's anything also on that front.
The talks, as you mentioned, they came to nothing in Geneva. So those talks were disastrous. And now we're expecting more talks to take place this week here in Brussels and Belgium and also in Vienna in Austria. But it's anticipated that there will be very little progress also in Brussels, because you have more people around the table and therefore you have big personalities, more sort of anti-Russia people to attend that meeting. And therefore, we're not anticipating a big breakthrough in Brussels. I mean, from Russia's perspective, the red line, according to Putin, is for Ukraine to join NATO. And of course, you know, you can understand, if you speak to security analysts, they point out that in recent years, there's just been a build-up, more and more military drills, so-called war games, as close to Russia's borders as possible, you know, on the Black Sea and also in NATO countries close to Russia. And so if it was a situation that Ukraine was to join NATO, you can imagine that that provocation would just increase. So that is a red line for Putin. We're not seeing where this is going to go in terms of escalation. But when I speak to experts in the field, they say, look, I mean, sort of a conventional, even a conventional military interaction or war with Russia is simply out of the question, really, because it just could escalate into nuclear war, which could have global catastrophe. So really, we've heard for years as well from experts that a war is not an option with Russia. And so the answer, perhaps, again, according to even some of the lawmakers in the European Parliament I've been speaking to, is to try and de-escalate the tensions with Russia, stop the anti-Russia rhetoric. Russia is a major supplier of energy to the European Union. They also trade, apart from energy, they also have some trade that used to be greater before Russia imposed reciprocal sanctions in terms of, you know, on agricultural products from the EU in response to EU sanctions. And so there's a feeling that the only way forward with Russia is to tone things down, stop the anti-Russia rhetoric, and try to get it on a more normal footing. But as things stand right now, and with these talks coming up in Brussels and Vienna, it doesn't look like that's likely.
Thank you for that, Jerome Hughes. We do appreciate it. Let me now introduce our guest for this edition of the Spotlight. We have senior research fellow, the Global Policy Institute, George Samioli, joining us from Budapest. We also have columnist and author, Patrick Lawrence. He joins us from Norfolk, Connecticut.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, let me first start with you, Patrick Lawrence. We're looking at the most recent statement from the talks, in which you had the Russian Deputy Foreign Minister, Sergei Ryabkov, said that no progress was made. Does that surprise you?
No, not particularly. I'm not sure the Western Alliance, Washington, its allies in Europe, particularly want a lot of progress here. It's a question of how each side views this current impasse. In my read, Moscow has taken a large view. Let us rethink our circumstances altogether. Western press reports note with some alarm. Russia wants to redraw European security architecture. That may well, that may count as a rather good description of what Russia seeks. And it's a pretty good idea. But I don't think the Western Alliance has this in mind. I don't think they almost certainly don't want a reduction in tensions. In my view, I've written this in various columns, they know they can't win a war with Russia. And so the intent is to maintain tensions at a very high level. That's useful enough.
Okay, I see. Well, let me bring in George Tomaioli, if I may. He is a senior research fellow at the Global Policy Institute, who joins us from Budapest. George Tomaioli, welcome. So our guest there talks about how the Western Alliance wants to keep pressure on Russia, but doesn't want to get involved in a war. Now, at the same time, we do have Russia that's very assertive, and in their mind, quite rightly so. But what Sergei Ryabkov has said here is very interesting, and I'd like to find out from you, in response to any failure of security talks, that it would be of a military technical nature. Furthermore, in another part of his statements, he said that he urged Washington, that is, not to underestimate the risk of a confrontation. How close are we to that?
Well, it's hard to say how close we are to that. I think it depends on what the West does in the near future. I think if, for instance, Ukraine launches any kind of an offensive against the Donbass, that will almost certainly trigger some kind of a Russian military intervention in Ukraine. If the United States and NATO start deploying heavy forces, stationing heavy weaponry in Ukraine, that also could trigger a Russian intervention. I think given that NATO and the United States have ruled out addressing the security concerns that Russia raised in those two documents, Russia now is saying, look, we've done our bit, we've proposed some kind of a mutually acceptable security framework, a kind of revamped Helsinki Final Act.
Right.
So now we are just going to take unilateral action whenever we deem things to be an existential threat to us, much as President Kennedy threatened to do in 1962 at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Again, you know, he felt that stationing missiles in Cuba was an existential threat to the United States, and basically told the Russians, either you take the missiles out or we will. I think the Russians are just saying that that's our position now. You haven't addressed our concerns, so now we're just going to act unilaterally whenever we think that there's a serious security threat facing us.
Well, here's a part that's confusing here. Maybe you could shed light on it, Patrick Lawrence. I mean, when you take a look at the different exchanges that took place prior to this, I mean, this meeting, when you have the Russian Deputy Foreign Minister in attendance, when you have the U.S. Deputy Secretary of State, Wendy Sherman, in attendance, and you're also going to have meetings of the NATO-Russia Council to take place in Brussels, and then the Permanent Council of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe also to meet. We can see how big and important this is. But the answers were exchanged between the two sides before coming into this, and we're getting the first signals of the failure of the talks. Do you think that there are any chances of anything being resolved here on any point, which we're going to talk about, such as Ukraine, such as NATO's eastward expansion?
Well, you know, I'd be interested in the comments of your correspondent in Brussels and George, for that matter. It starts to shape up that these talks in three European capitals this week are a matter of form, a matter of going through the motions. As you've just suggested, could it be that everything has been decided already and there's simply going to be no progress? It's very depressing. I draw some encouragement from the fact that Russia has a very good set of cards here. I don't think NATO would dare go in directly into Ukraine. I think it looks like membership is, for the time being, off the table, although they are not saying so. What seems to be going on?
Why do you think it's off the table?
What I mean is this. Let me finish. What I mean is they're not going to press for membership, but they're going to make Ukraine a de facto member. Jens Stoltenberg, NATO's chief, is already saying, look, Ukraine's a partner. We can't make it a member right now, but it's a partner. And I think the focus now seems to be creating facts on the ground and worry about treaties and fountain pens at another moment, right? That I find worrisome.
Well, George Samueli, on Ukraine and the point that our guests there made, could it be that even though Stoltenberg today said we are entertaining that thought, that they haven't done that yet because Ukraine has expressed, obviously, its interest from a while back, that Ukraine is being used in a sense where they're going to be on the offensive, hoping that NATO or the U.S. or a combination is going to come to its rescue? Do you think that that's a scenario that could be a possibility here?
Well, yeah, and I think that this is the most depressing aspect of it because, you know, from NATO's perspective, and NATO doesn't give a damn about Ukraine, but what they like about Ukraine is that it gives Russia a headache. This ongoing war in the southeast of Ukraine is a real headache for Russia. I mean, Russia wants to resolve this problem, but it's finding it very hard to do simply because Kiev absolutely refuses to agree to the Minsk Accord. So, you know, Kiev wants this essential tension to continue. NATO wants this tension to continue. So if it happens that Russia is forced to intervene militarily to protect the Donbass from Kiev, it will mean an enormous rift between Russia and Europe. I mean, it'll bring to an end all of Russia's hopes of using German investment and technical know-how to develop their country, all of Russia's hopes of building a partnership with Europe, it'll all come to an end. For NATO, and particularly the United States, this is great news because it'll be a big boost for NATO because it's going to actually put, energize NATO, and, you know, everyone's going to be on board for increasing NATO spending and, escalate the hysterical NATO rhetoric. It's great for the United States because they've always dreaded the prospect of a European-Russian partnership. And Ukraine, you know, which has now lost Crimea, has lost the Donbass, could then be incorporated within NATO because, hey, why not? There isn't a conflict any longer in the country. They've lost the territory, but now there's no conflict. Therefore, Ukraine is eligible for membership. It no longer has a conflict on its territory. I think it's a terrible scenario. I hope it doesn't happen, but I think it's a possibility.
Well, I'd like to pick up on that point that you made in terms of how the U.S. does not really, or overall, of what I've picked up from you, that the U.S. doesn't like this partnership between Europe and Russia. And
it's an excellent point.
Yeah, and let's break that open for us, if you can, Patrick Lawrence. And I'm going to come in at you with what extreme measures that they're thinking of executing against Russia, and I'm looking at some of them. Sanctions on Putin's inner circle, canceling Russia's controversial Nord Stream 2 pipeline, something that obviously the U.S. wants to not happen so it could sell its own gas. And in the most drastic scenario, serving Russia's links to the world's banking system. You can see all of this could be a win situation for the U.S. Could it be these are underlying interests of the U.S. in this whole thing that's panning out?
As George just suggested, there's no question of this. Basically, the Americans have their finger in the dike, and let's call the dike history, right? Interdependence between Russia and Western Europe, I think, is inevitable, and the Americans dread it. It means the end of the Atlantic Alliance as it has been known since 45, right? I don't think there's any stopping this. Certain European leaders are perfectly aware of this. One of them is Macron, French president. Merkel seems to have understood this at certain points during her chancellorship. And the Americans want to stop this. Nord Stream 2 was rather emblematic of the effort. And it now transpires that they haven't given up on Nord Stream 2 even after it's completed. As George said, very worrisome. But I think the drift of events in coming years, I'm talking medium term now, not immediately, is greatly in favor of a very productive interdependence between the Russian Federation and nations around it and Western Europe. I'd love to see it. Right. Time marches on.
Well, another thing that's very a big question mark over here, and George Samueli, it's a statement that Wendy Sherman made that from the U.S., and I'm going to quote what she said. The U.S. will listen to Russia's concerns and share our own, but we have been clear we will not discuss European security without our allies and partners. So what is the U.S. doing there? I mean, why isn't Ursula von der Leyen there, the European Commission president, representing Europe?
Yeah, that's right. The West position since the end of the Cold War was that we will show no respect whatsoever for Russia. Russia is not the same as the Soviet Union. You know, it's half the size of the Soviet Union, and therefore doesn't deserve any of the respect that we once showed towards the Soviet Union. It's now broken up into 15 republics, and any of those republics will be scooped up by us NATO. And we've already scooped up the former Warsaw Pact allies of Russia. We've already scooped up the three Baltic states. Now we're kind of moving in on Georgia and Ukraine, promised membership in 2008, Moldova, and then onwards towards Central Asia and towards the Far East. Every single one of the former republics of the USSR is a target of NATO. They're going to put all of that in and push Russia out of everything. I mean, that's the goal. I'm not saying they're going to achieve it, but that's been the goal. So they don't have any respect for Russia. So they just say, these are ridiculous demands. But what has changed is that Russia has now become much stronger than it was a few years ago. And now, I think they've got the West's attention, and they're kind of realizing that we can't just go on like this because it could lead ultimately to a military conflict. But I think that if the United States and Stoltenberg, the kind of errand boy, if they succeed in kind of essentially breaking, forging a permanent rift between Russia and Europe, I think that then they will say, job well done. You know, we succeeded. I mean, just like, you know, the coup in 2014 when they toppled Yanukovych, you know, I think this is a job well done. We've done it, minimum expense to us, and it's a real serious problem for Russia. And I think that is the danger, that they're trying to provoke a Russian intervention in Ukraine, which would then trigger this permanent rift between Russia and Europe.
Well, if we were to take an optimistic view for the next few days, at a minimum at least, moving forward here, what are we looking at in terms of the core issues? For example, when we talk about eastward expansion of NATO, Patrick Lawrence, or if we're talking about the Ukraine in terms of the troop buildup by Russia, which, by the way, there are no aerials given of this troop buildup by Russia. We don't see the tens of thousands of Russian troops, as they have said. Anyways, even if they were to get an agreement on any of these issues, well, NATO has backed out of its promises of its eastward expansion. The U.S. has torn up international agreements. So how can Russia even depend and trust on any agreement that may come out of these talks.
Yeah, you know, you make an excellent point. It's very possible that Ukraine becomes something like NATO's Waterloo. It's probable that it will not, it's almost certain that NATO is not going to go into Ukraine directly. And I think it's going to refrain from any substantive moves toward membership. And in that case, if I prove correct here, NATO will have defined its own limits. It will have created a swamp all by itself and then fallen into it. And so, you know, once again, I think it's an excellent thing that that Russia has various advantages in this, because I have no belief whatsoever that Russia wants to go into Ukraine. It's all you read about in the dailies over here and on the networks. There's no indication whatsoever that Russia wants to go into Ukraine, right? And that's a very fine thing.
Okay.
It shouldn't.
George Tomilli, in conclusion over here, of course, we know that this is about Russia, Ukraine, and NATO's eastward expansion at the top of the list. But could it be that there are other discussions taking place involving other issues that will play as pieces in this chessboard, perhaps a give and take, even though Russia has said it's not going to give any concessions, in order for this situation to get resolved in one way or another on any of these issues?
Well, they're talking about revamping the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, and the Americans have sounded relatively positive about that. I'm very skeptical that anything much is going to happen here, because the United States would then have to make substantial concessions. I mean, the United States have been violating the INF Treaty, basically the whole kind of nonsense of you know, setting up these missile defense systems in Romania and now in Poland. I mean, that's basically a missile is a missile, and those are missiles that can carry nuclear warheads, and they are intermediate-range nuclear missiles. So the United States is already violating that.
Okay.
So they would have to give all that up in order to have a revamped INF treaty. I don't think that they're going to do that.
All right, very well. We're fresh out of time. Thank you very much for that, George Tomilli, Senior Research Fellow at the Global Policy Institute. Patrick Welch, thank you. I'm sorry, Patrick Lawrence, thank you. From Norfolk, Connecticut, columnist and author. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight.